The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, Florida Senator Rick Scott, chair of the Republican Senatorial Committee, gives us an overview of the key races in the Senate.
We're going to be able to defend our 50, right? And then we got two-plus pickup opportunities.
Herschel Walker, in a tight race in Georgia, responds to some of the latest from his opponent.
And as I was just saying, the left seemed to want to keep bringing up my past. And they don't realize, like, bringing up my past, like trying to rob my old house. I don't live there anymore.
And the polling. Robert Cahaley of Trafalgar.
There's no shift. This is exactly what they did last time. They acted like it was a last-minute shift in Virginia. There was no last-minute shift in Virginia. The stuff going on in those schools has been going on since May.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program, please, each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And please follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. The election is now on us. Early voting has begun in a number of states across the nation. Last week, we heard from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy with a look at the House. You can catch that at TownHallReview.com. This week, we'll catch up with Rick Scott, senator from storm-ravaged Florida and chairman of the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee. I want to run through the Senate map with you, Senator. I was going to start with the five must-holds by Republicans, but let's start with the would-be Republican takeover in Georgia since Herschel Walker's in the news. Is Herschel Walker's campaign damaged by the abortion story in the Daily Beast or the angry tweets by his son?
Oh, look, this is just textbook 101 for the Democrats. But they know they're going to lose. Herschel Walker's running a good race. He's a great candidate. Raphael Warnock is Joe Biden. And, you know, it's just this lies, cheat, and smear. That's what the Democrats do. They did it to Brett Kavanaugh. They did it to Clarence Thomas. They're doing it to Herschel Walker. But he's going to win. And so
the Daily Beast story might fit into that category. Do the tweets from his son matter?
No. I mean, you know what people are going to vote about? They care about what's, you know, is Herschel or Raphael Warnock going to be better for the economy, for your kids' education, for public safety, for a secure border, for our lethal military? It's a pretty easy choice. It's easy to pick Herschel Walker over Raphael Warnock.
Now, let me run down the five Republican-held seats that Democrats had a hope for at some time or another. Alaska, Lisa Murkowski. Missouri, where Eric Schmidt is ahead. Ohio, where J.D. Vance is ahead. He's coming in here later. Pennsylvania, where Dr. Oz is at least tied and surging. North Carolina, Ted Budd. Where are you putting most of your resources? I think they're all locked up, but you tell me.
Well, first off, Eric Schmidt's way ahead. We're going to win Alaska. Next, Ron Johnson. People talk about Ron. Ron's never been ahead in the poll ever. He's ahead. I mean, Oz is running a great race. He's either tied to barely down. He's surging. People aren't going to vote for Fetterman. They're not even, Democrats don't even want to spend money in North Carolina because they know Sherry Beasley cannot beat Ted Budd. So we're going to be able to defend our 50, right? And then we've got two-plus pickup opportunities. We'll win in Georgia. We'll win in Nevada. We have a chance to win in Arizona, Colorado, Washington, New Hampshire, Connecticut. Now, the logical ones are Arizona. Look at Joe Day. Joe Day's down one right now to Michael Bennett, who ran for president. Nobody even knows.
I think Colorado is the biggest sleeper, Senator. I follow it very, very closely. And Joe Day's a wonderful candidate. I mean, you did a great job in recruiting him. Let's go that list again. The likeliest pickup is Nevada.
Number one is Nevada. Number two is Georgia. Number three would be somewhere between Arizona, Colorado, and Washington. They're all winnable. And we got great candidates. Joe Biden's under 40 in all those states. And our Democrat opponent is way under 50. We've spent money early in to find them. So Bennett's in about the mid-40s in approval. Patty Murray's in the same position. We've got We've got Mark Kelly at about 47% approval. So our candidates are running good races. We're going to win.
Herschel Walker has been in a tight race in Georgia, tighter than it ought to be and perhaps tighter still as a result of the last-minute October surprise sort of effort from his opponent, the radical Reverend Raphael Warnock. Walker was a guest on my program. The Daily Beast has updated the story about your paying for a woman's abortion. The anonymous woman has now also alleged that she had a child by you. Your response?
I'll say the same thing I said, that I know this is untrue. I know it's untrue, and they keep telling me things like that, and it's totally, totally untrue. And I'm not sure why that will be told. I know nothing about any woman having an abortion, and so they can keep coming at me like that, and they're doing it because they want to distract people. I know that because I've already been forgiven, and if I've been forgiven, why in the world will I not be forgiven of something like that?
Is there anything you need to be forgiven for vis-a-vis a woman whose name we do not know? Do you know who this woman is, and do you need to be forgiven?
Well, that's what's so funny. And I'm saying I've been forgiven because of all the things I did when I went to the thing with my ex-wife and all that, and things I did, I don't know how many years ago that I wrote in my book. I said, guys, I wasn't perfect. I had my problem with mental health. I have a new life, and I've been moving forward. And if that had happened, I would have said it because there's nothing to be ashamed of there. People have done that, but I know nothing about it. And if I knew about it, I would be honest and talk about it. But I know nothing about that.
Herschel, it was not on my question set until they re-upped the story this morning and added to it a new allegation. So just to put a bow on it, do you have any idea who this alleged former lover of yours is who says you paid for an abortion and fathered a child? Any idea whatsoever?
I have no idea at all. And that's the problem is, when they said that I had kids that I was hiding, a lot of people don't know that this same reporter found out that this was not true. Never wrote a retraction, never said anything. They just let it go and went on. And in this case here, they're saying, some alleged woman, and now somebody that you used to know and you know so well and this and that is saying it. And I said, yeah, they can say a lot of things, but I know for a fact no one has ever told me or I paid for an abortion and that never happened.
Okay, I want to talk about your son, Christian Walker. This has got to be painful for everyone in your family. But what do you say to Christian about these videos he's released, these texts?
Oh, gee, I say that I love Christian. I love him with all my heart. I always have, always will. And as I was just saying, the left seemed to want to bring up my past. And they don't realize, bringing up my past, like trying to rob my old house. I don't live there anymore.
Have you sat down with him during the campaign?
No, I haven't. I haven't sat down with him since the story came out about me having other kids. I haven't sat down at all then. And that's what I told everyone. I said, guys, I haven't sat down with Christian since he started believing, I think. And he started believing that I had other kids, never told him about it. And I think he was extremely hurt from that. And that was totally, totally not true. And that's what was so sad. And we haven't talked about it, and this came out, and that's why I said I love him. I love Christian. I love him with all my heart, he's a young man now, and so when he's ready, I'm here. He can talk to me.
Now I want to close this up, but I want to make sure I understand. When you say it's totally not true that you had children by other than his mother, is it? What are you referring to?
No, I'm saying it's not true when they talked about me paying for someone abortion. And so when they talked about me paying for someone abortion, that is not true. And all of the stuff that is coming out is not true. And I'm not sure what Christian is talking about because he said some things. And I just said that I love Christian. I'm not going to debate or talk about that out in public because I need to know exactly what he's talking about or what he just said about with me.
All right, so let's go to the campaign. What have these charges done, if anything, to the momentum for Team Herschel on the road?
Well, I'm still doing what I was doing. I'm still getting the people out. And the people have seen it. And, you know, it's one thing somebody told me yesterday that I never heard this statement before. They said, Herschel, now you know about the October surprise. And I said, I have never heard of that statement before. They said, yeah, in October, right before they get ready to go to the election, they come up with an October surprise for you. And I said, I've never heard of that, but I said, I'm going to win this election, and my crowd is still coming out. And I think that's what everyone want to talk about. I mean to say all the reporters want to talk about this, but the people in the audience seem to, they want to talk about everything else.
And yeah, Herschel, that might be part of your appeal. I was raised on October surprises. Lyndon Johnson stopping the bombing of North Korea a month before the election. George W. Bush's ancient DUI being dropped a week before the election that made a runaway close. That, you know, October surprises, if I had tattoos, it would be tattooed on me somewhere. So it is. You are clearly not a politician.
No, I'm not. I'm not a politician. So if somebody told me that statement, I had no clue what they were talking about. Right now, you know, I believe in America. Right now, I believe in the Georgia people. Right now, we need to know that and people see it right now. Inflation is starting to go up again. Gas prices are starting to go up again. Right now, you know, this border is wide open, getting worse. Halloween is right around the corner. They're dressing fentanyl to look like candy. I want all the parents to be vigilant about that. That's what they left don't want to talk about. Well, I'm talking about that. Because, as I said, to continue to try to hurt me by bringing up my past is like robbing my old house. I don't live there anymore.
So, Herschel, let's close by talking about Pastor Warnock. I am amazed. I stayed away from the story about the domestic violence against his ex-wife or wife. I can't remember who he ran over. But I didn't do that when he ran in the runoff. It's just not what I do on this show. Are you getting hit by a double standard in the media where the pastor gets a pass on his double salary and you get hammered on anonymous allegations like this? Is it a double standard? Do Georgians know that?
Well, I don't think Georgians know that. But, you know, that's not something I really bring up, because I said it yesterday to someone who asked the same question. I said, you know, right now the people want to know what I'm going to be as a senator. And, you know, the allegations, when you say allegations, unless they are true, unless I know they are true, I don't talk about it, because it's, you know, I think it's unfair to the senator. I want to talk about his record. Right now, his record is terrible. His voting is terrible for Georgia. And then, you know, he's done this in less than 2 years, and he asked him for six more years. And my question is, can we put up with this for six more years? I'm saying, no, we can't. We cannot continue to go like this for six more years.
Coming up, we look at the polling.
There's no shift. This is exactly what they did last time. They acted like it was a last-minute shift in Virginia. There was no last-minute shift in Virginia. The stuff going on in those schools has been going on since May.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy enters our 25th anniversary year, we've remained committed to a single truth of world history, that ideas have consequences. To understand these ideas and their impact on today's politics, and to test them quantitatively, requires the unique curriculum we offer on our Malibu, California campus. Apply now for fall classes at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Political polling in our nation is broken. It's been broken for some time, but the brokenness became acute and obvious to even the casual observer since 2016. There are a number of reasons. The modeling, the bias within the polling outfits, and the generational shift in our culture, and the simple reluctance of some people to answer their phones. One polling organization has been considerably more accurate than the other, the Trafalgar Group. Robert Cahaley of Trafalgar was a guest of Sebastian Gorka.
You have the reputation of being the most reliable pollsters in America. How did you do that, Robert?
Well, we started by telling people the truth and started with the simple belief that polls shouldn't be about agenda. You know, people can question, all right, well, is this pollster a Republican or is this pollster a Democrat? that really shouldn't matter, because the objective truth of what the numbers are is what it is. But unfortunately, we live in an environment where we have media-dominated polling and dominated by our universities as well. Both of them are known for having a liberal bias, and we certainly see that demonstrated through some of the polling. And in addition to that, a lot of the polling that we're seeing is just so agenda-driven. It's just...
But it's not just gender-driven, Robert. It just looks like so bloody amateurish. I'll see, you know, some newspaper article where they're trying to make a big deal out of a poll with 900 respondents. I put a survey on my Twitter. I'll get 20,000 respondents to a survey within a couple of hours. It just looks like half of these people are lazy, Robert.
Well, part of it is lazy. And the other thing is their model is broken. That's why I've always jokingly referred to them as the Pony Express pollsters, because what they're doing is just completely out of date. You know, in today's world, for banks, for example, they figured out that some people come in, some people would rather go to the ATM, some people would rather deposit their checks using an app, some would rather call on the phone, but they may make the banking accessible to everybody. Well, polling needs to do the same if we want to hit everyone. And so what they're doing is they're using their old-fashioned models, calling people at their homes with, or even on their cell phones, with 40-question polls. Well, the number one question we get is, how long is this going to take? And if the answer is more than 3 minutes or, you know, it's just 6 questions, people hang up.
Yeah.
So you end up with people who care way too much taking these polls. And then you're right, the survey samples are very small sometimes, 400, 700. We don't believe in anything under 1,000 per state, and under about 1,090 for nationwide, because we're trying to get the margin of error below 3. And so those are just some basic differences, but we also give people ways to participate with text and email and phone calls as well, and other online methods, because people react differently. You're not getting any millennials or Gen Zs if you're just calling people
right
on the phone with no option to text.
My kids don't even use phones to talk anymore. It's always text. It's always DMs. Robert, you told me, I saw you last at the Media Research Council gala a week ago, and you told me a fascinating story about a recent poll that you guys tried to take, and then you had some very interesting responses from the people you are asking or trying to ask questions of. So tell us that story to our listeners.
Well, basically what we've done is that in 2016 we had shy voters. You had to use a vehicle to get them to say they were for Trump. They were hesitant because Trump's the... By 2020, they were just hesitant to take polls. We had to work really hard to get them to take polls, and you had to make sure you got your sample right, because the kind of Republicans who didn't like Trump couldn't wait to take a poll, and the kind of Republicans who did were very hesitant. So if you weren't careful, you were overestimating the never Trump Republicans.
And let's stop there for a second, Robert. Why were they hesitant back then?
Well, it was 2020. We were in the middle of cancel culture. People were being doxxed. They were being attacked for having any conservative views. At that point, we'd been through the whole thing of the summer with all the statues and the riots and all that stuff. And so people were just very... It was a very polarized environment, and people were asking questions about the pandemic and about how people felt about all this stuff. It just led to an overall feeling of conservatives just didn't want to be judged. They didn't want to be called for holding conservative positions. I mean, by 2020, being for Trump meant somebody could just call you racist without ramifications.
And then what happened in this latest survey that was so interesting?
Well, this is what we've seen now, and this is not just one survey, it's a pattern now, is that they don't want to take surveys at all. It's not a matter of you have to find them. They don't want to. What we've seen is, after Biden's speech especially, we've seen so many Republicans are telling us, here's what I was explaining to you, is after the speech, we started being approached from people who would email us or send us a voicemail or even play a tape of one of our surveys. And the days that followed, when we were doing other statewide surveys, they were saying, hey, I got this survey. Is it you? I didn't want to say anything. I didn't know what...
So they didn't believe it was Trafalgar, so they would call you up directly or email you to say, hey, I don't trust this approach, right?
Yeah, they were saying that they didn't trust anything, and they wanted to make sure it was us before they took it.
Finish your thought about how people simply, they don't trust any pollsters today if they're conservatives. Finish your thought.
Well, they're just worried that this overreaching government might, it doesn't seem an unreasonable thing that they might be keeping track of what people tell in polls. They might be keeping track of what people say. So what we found is people that used to put a sign in their yard or a sticker on their car or comment on social media are doing none of it, and they're not participating in polls, and we call these submerged voters, people that no one's going to hear from. That, you know, they're underwater until Election Day.
All right, so they're hiding under the surface. So then give us the truth. Give us the sanity check, Robert. We're being told by the Democrats that, oh, there's no tidal wave coming. We're going to keep the House. We're going to keep the Senate. Roe v. Wade has energized, you know, white suburban women or whatever it is. Is that just all, you know, bluster? Is that propaganda?
Well, a good bit of it is. I mean, because first there is this, you know, like I said, these submerged voters that are going to outdo what any poll says, including ours. I think the Republican turnout will be better than what we say. But no, there's no question. These guys tried to set a narrative because they were trying to impact these races early in the, you know, in September and in late July and August. They were trying to put these numbers out, the left-leaning media and the universities, because they helped the Democrats raise money.
Right.
And they knew this was nowhere near reality. They're trying to create a reality and help create a raise a bunch of money. But now that it's getting close to the election, they're going to have egg on their face again. All of a sudden, they're starting to say, well, we see a shift. There's no shift. This is exactly what they did last time. They acted like it was a last-minute shift in Virginia. There was no last-minute shift in Virginia. The stuff going on in those schools has been going on since May.
Okay, that's the truth. There's no last-minute shift. There's just submerged voters who understand what the left is doing to intimidate them. What is your expectation for the House and the Senate?
Obviously, any crazy national crisis can happen. So I don't want to predict 5 weeks. I'll say if the election were next week, the Republicans would win the House by 30 votes, and they'd win the Senate by 2.
Coming up, Dr. Oz on his opponent in Pennsylvania.
He's actually a danger in ways that go beyond just Pennsylvania. His first decision he'll make, he says, is to get rid of the filibuster.
When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us.
This is Molly Hemingway. In 2020, millions of Americans experienced the most troubling election of their lives. That's why I wrote the book Rigged: How Big Tech, the Media, and Democrats Seized Our Elections. I write about Mark Zuckerberg's efforts to take over election operations in key states, how the coronavirus was used to force election laws designed explicitly to help the Democrat Party, and much, much more.
It's now in paperback. Don't miss Molly Hemingway's book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Available wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. As we look at the 2022 election, there's a dynamic that an insufficient number of people have given attention to. That is, the genuinely radical nature of many of these Democratic nominees. Sticking with just the Senate for now. Senator Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Republican, is facing Mandela Barnes, Democrat, a proponent of defunding the police. Herschel Walker, Republican in Georgia, is facing a very, very eloquent defender of Marxism in Dr. Warnock. And our next guest, Dr. Oz, is facing a man many have called the most radical nominee for the Senate of them all, Carhartt John Fetterman. Dr. Oz was a guest on my program. I mean, Democrats think this is their one takeaway opportunity left because Ron Johnson has surged and they're now on the defense.
Well, it's amazing that a lot of Democrats, and particularly far-left liberals, it's not really the Democrats in general, the conservative Democrats that I actually will be getting votes from here in Pennsylvania, but a lot of the far-left Democrats living on the coast, California and New York, are of the belief Fetterman's fine. He just wants, you know, they want the 51st seat to be a Democratic seat. The risk here is that he's actually a danger in ways that go beyond just Pennsylvania. His first decision he'll make, he says, is to get rid of the filibuster, which I think is a problem for all of us, Democrats, Republicans, independents, because it would make the country sway from side to side much more aggressively. And we want the Senate to be and remain the greatest deliberative body in the world, and it needs to be able to temper some of the decisions made by the executive branch alike. And you can't do that if get rid of the filibuster. I'm trying to focus on the kitchen table problems faced by Pennsylvanians. Now, the concerns about crime are real because many in Pennsylvania were already concerned about Fetterman not understanding what cops have to do to get their job done. He's undermined them. That's the reason that the Fraternal Order of Police have been across the Commonwealth endorsing me. They really dislike John Fetterman because he's been undermining them. And some of the things he said, wanting to release one-third of all prisoners, a passion for getting criminals sentenced to life in prison for murder out of jail. When he was asked if you could wave a magic wand, what's the one thing you would do? And he said, get rid of life sentences. And I'm thinking, my goodness, what about the victims? Why do you always protect the criminal over the innocent? This is a message when we send to folks, especially in places like Philadelphia, where we have the highest murder rate ever. We had our 1,000th carjacking over the weekend. People can't fathom this. How can you not take care of people who aren't even comfortable walking to work anymore? And yet you're out there pontificating on Twitter, usually in 140 character messages, about how you want to get all these murderers out of jail. And it's a problem also because of the lawlessness with drugs in Pennsylvania.
I want to talk to you about both inflation and education. I want to start with the Wall Street Journal lead editorial today. It's about Illinois, but it applies to Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and other inner city school systems as well. Statewide in 2019, 36% of all third graders could read at grade level. That's an F, and that's the good news. That's Illinois. I imagine local public education is in the same hole in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, Dr. Oz. It's not a federal issue, it's a local issue, but how often does it come up, the collapse of public schools, on your campaign?
Comes up frequently. It's a major problem, especially for children at risk, moms who are just barely holding it together, don't have the financial resources to pick better schools for their children. My opponent, of course, is strongly endorsed by the teachers union, does not want charter schools, but I feel passionately that we need more charter schools. And we also, I believe, need to create a fund at the federal level to squeeze and push states to allow parents to choose parochial schools for their children. That's the kind of topic that I would push for as a U.S. senator. I can't get my opponent, Fetterman, to talk about these kinds of serious issues. He's busy, making the kinds of statements you just highlighted.
The Fetterman campaign is just hoping that Twitter is somehow the real world. It's not. Dr. Oz, let's close with inflation because the numbers will come out right before the election. Gas prices in California are back above $6 a gallon. The second wave of gas hikes are coming on top of the inflation in food. I can't imagine Democrats winning in this environment. They unleashed this tsunami of rising prices.
They did it despite warnings that it would happen. They've allocated $5 trillion of our children's money to the different social spending programs, which have also destroyed some of the workforce enthusiasm. And we haven't even spent all $5 trillion. We have $2 trillion left to spend. More money chasing the same goods is going to create more inflation. So we're going to see a continued increase in the cost of groceries and foods and energy. It's not just gasoline. It's energy to heat your home. And people are paying that money right now in order to fill up their tanks so they're ready for the winter, and they're not happy about it. But I think there's a bigger issue here. It causes a big-time emotional stress that leads to physical problems as well. We don't talk about this part of the economic downturn, but you make people sick when you take away their livelihood, when you take away their confidence that they can control their destiny. When they're trying to make ends meet and nothing seems to get them there, they feel hopeless. Nihilism takes over. And that's not what America's ever been about.
Coming up, our cancel culture. It's really nothing new at all.
I think there is some kind of pretty straight line from the social gospel of the early 20th century to the social justice of the early 21st century, and they're both very entangled with a certain progressive form of Christianity.
Peter Thiel, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When you look at our tensely divided nation, We see a very prevalent effort to cancel people, to scapegoat and blame, to derail careers in entire segments of our population. White males are perhaps the most favored target. But if we take a step back, none of this is particularly new for humanity. It's an age-old cycle. And Peter Thiel, typically a very private man, has been talking about the cycle with Jerry Boyer, my colleague on the Salem editorial board. The co-founder of PayPal was guest of Boyer's Meeting of the Minds podcast.
Last time, you basically introduced people to the role that Rene Girard played in your life. And you kind of took us through how the Bible reads us. We think we're reading the Bible, but the Bible's really reading us. And you can step in and like take away the recap from me, but I'll just recap a little bit. And how the scapegoat mechanism is what the pagan world was built on. Christianity exposed the scapegoat mechanism, robbed it of its power. But now in postmodernism, we have a deformed outgrowth of Christianity, what you call the woke religion, which is always in search of victims to defend and always trying to scapegoat the scapegoaters. Does that sound like a pretty fair summary of our conversation before?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair summary. There's always some sense in which you could say that archaic culture or even sort of quasi satanic forms of government is the past that Christianity has abolished. But we're not living in the kingdom of heaven where all these forms don't exist anymore. Girard would say there still are all these kinds of scapegoating mechanisms that people are trying to figure out some ways to get these things to work again. Maybe you have to increase the dosage. So this would be like the totalitarian catastrophes of the 20th century where you couldn't just kill, a random witch in a village. You had to kill millions and millions of people. So it was sort of like this drug that doesn't work as well anymore. As people understand how it works, it paradoxically works less well. But that doesn't mean that people give up on it. They can increase the dosage. And then I think it can also go in these very strange sort of, maybe I'm not sure if hyper-Christian is the right word, but sort of modern, postmodern ways where we scapegoat the scapegoaters. We go after the people who were historical victimizers. So, in a communist context, it was the bourgeoisie, the aristocracy, the czar, the capitalists, and then in a woke 21st century American context, it is the descendants of the slave owners, the white people. The people who can somehow be tied to this historical victimization, and then we victimize the victimizers, and somehow that still is always a pretty powerful move in our world. There's often a way to think of Nazism and communism as sort of enemy doubles. They're sort of mimetic twins, very, very similar to each other. Stalin, Hitler, they even had sort of both had sort of preposterous mustaches, and so all these sort of ways that they copied one another. And I think even the mass murder in some ways was mimetically copied from them. But one important difference is that Nazism was always going back to the past. It was sort of pagan, and it was the historical victims really were guilty. The Jews, the handicapped people, the gays, these were genuinely the victims. Whereas communism was somehow a little bit more sophisticated, where it said that there were all these victims, and we have to go after we have to victimize the victimizers, and that was sort of like a slightly more sophisticated move. And I think Girard had sort of this intuition that even though they were, enemy doubles, in some ways very parallel, there's something about communism or wokeism that's the more powerful, threat in our world, because it's sort of like it's a second order victimization that still can work very powerfully.
And it has the power of the gospel. I mean, it's a distorted form. So the way you're describing this, in essence, fascism is a throwback to the pagan order. It's pre-Christian. We're just going to go back to, killing the outsider. We're going to, kill Oedipus. And communism is sort of post-Christian, but it has that, there's a power to the gospel story, and it taps into that power.
And this is probably always, it's not a terribly new phenomenon. There's always been, sort of a natural way for the gospel to be distorted in this way, where there's some sort of temptation for Christians to be more Christian than the other Christian, more Christian than Christ, you know, that probably already in the, you know, first, second century AD, someone like Marcion, who tried to be progressive relative to St. Paul and say that, you know, the Old Testament God was too violent and he had too many victims. And so we have to radically differentiate the New Testament God from the Old Testament God. And we have to have this sort of more peaceful, loving God of the New Testament. And then, of course, it sort of was a way to had an anti-Semitic undercurrent to it and all these things. But then you can think of from Marcion to Marx, a sort of a straight line. You have, of course, in Tolstoy, where the Christians will have, you know, we'll have peace in the kingdom of heaven. Here we will have peace on this earth. We'll do more than the Christians. In some ways, in an American context, I think there is some kind of pretty straight line from the social gospel of the early 20th century to the social justice of the early 21st century, and they're both, you know, very, very entangled with a certain progressive form of Christianity.
Yeah, I think the point you're making, well, you are making it, is essentially that what we see in this progressivism is not de novo. That there's almost like linear descent. You know, you can see the transitional forms. It's not, you know, some brand new, you know, creature that in sort of Protestant mainlineism, you go from that to the social gospel.
Yes. The other dimension that I think is not thought of enough is this very deeply Christian, Judeo-Christian religious dimension to it, where, if it's a zero-sum Darwinian, Malthusian game that's going on, why does it take this specific form? You know, we still have to say, why is it so focused on victims? Why is it so focused on these particular things? And I think that's where you have to think very hard about this religious question. And of course, there is, you know, I would say there is, there is a dimension to it where, you know, it's not completely wrong within a Christian context. We should have concern for the victims. There should be some kind of social gospel or social justice. It shouldn't be the main things, but it is somehow adjacent enough that it's a very big temptation. And then there are the ways that it can go wrong should be very understandable.
We've caught a lot more of the conversation between the tech icon Peter Thiel and Jerry Boyer. Go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
poor people against rich people against poor people.
Brandon Tatum in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Georgine Rice. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. If you listen to the left, this election cycle is all about abortion. Pro-life activist Abby Johnson is not so sure.
I don't believe that abortion is the primary issue when people are going to the polls, but unfortunately, the angry mob, they are showing up to vote.
But in certain states, it's absolutely on the ballot. We'll look at California's Prop 1.
On the day of the baby's birth, the baby can still be denied life.
Also motivating voters, the issue of education.
The Mama Bear Apologetics is based on this idea that when they see something coming after their child, that maternal instinct just turns into this ferocious creature that says, not my kids, not today.
Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Floridians continue their recovery efforts in the wake of Hurricane Ian. The damage is brutal on lives, property, infrastructure. And Vice President Kamala Harris weighed in early on disaster assistance, intimating that some of it, at least, was going to be distributed by race. In other words, via equitable consideration. Here's Brandon Tatum.
Kamala Harris should be shunned. Not only her word salads that she say almost every single day of her life, but also what she said in a parallel that she's trying to draw to racism, racial bias, and Hurricane Ian. I just can't believe this woman. These people are so dirty.
It is our lowest income communities and our communities of color that are most impacted by these extreme conditions and impacted by issues that are not of their own making. And
so women.
We, Absolutely. And so we have to address this in a way that is about giving resources based on equity, understanding that we fight for equality, but we also need to fight for equity, understanding not everyone starts out at the same place. And if we want people to be in an equal place, sometimes we have to take into account those disparities and do that work.
Dumbest woman on planet Earth. It's weird to me that they want to pit poor people against rich people against poor people. It's asinine to me. Just because you have money don't necessarily mean that your dad was this mogul that had billions of dollars that they just handed to you. You know, a lot of people who are wealthy, a lot of people who have big organizations, they take extremely volatile risks. They are not sitting like you think they're sitting. Some of these major organizations weren't profitable for like the first 5 years. You look at places like Tesla and you look at Monster Energy Drink. And some of these places were not necessarily as prosperous the first few years. They had loans. People took chances. You know, you look at Elon Musk and some of these other guys. They were saying that they were sleeping on the floor. Zuckerberg dropped out of school. He was in a dorm room working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I know people don't like him because, I mean, I don't really like the fact that he's pushing the censorship stuff. But when you talk about entrepreneurial spirit, before Facebook was anything, that dude was pretty much sleeping on the floor. You know, wealth and people who are not wealthy, we do not need to have this pitch against each other. It does not need to be that way. We need to understand that we work together in unison to make a better place for all of us. Somebody got to work and somebody got to take the risk to create jobs. Somebody got to do it.
Thank you for joining us today. Town Hall Review is part of the Salem Podcast Network. If you haven't signed up for our podcast yet, why not take a minute to do so? Go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producer David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Tim Gantner, Jacob Orduña, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.